You want your website to tell the story of, you have this problem, we can help you on the path, here's the fix to it. If you want help on it, let us know. We can help. So a more story-based structure to the messaging of the site, that's element one. Element two is figuring out how you can implement true interaction into your website.
This is Bridging the Gap with your host, Matt Reiner.
Johnny Sanquist, Omaha, Nebraska. Welcome to the show, my friend. How are you?
Matt, thank you so much, man. I'm doing well.
Good, man. Doing it's well. Great to see you. I was saying before we started recording, I'm stoked to have you on. I've been following your stuff and following you for a while and just super impressed and the impact you're making. So this will be fun. This will be a fun conversation. So thanks for taking the time, man.
Yeah, man. Thank you for having me. I've had a lot of friends on the show, and so I've listened to this. You know, you had Corey Westfall on from Mobile Assistant not too long ago, and so I was stoked when you reached out. This is fantastic. We're gonna have a good time.
Yeah, Corey's great. I think he might be coming on again soon. So that's just like a teaser that they say in the radio biz. You know, stay tuned for another episode with Corey Westfall. But
absolutely.
Yeah, man, we're gonna talk about AI. We'll talk about marketing. We'll talk about, you know, I am curious and I hope we can get to it. I want to talk about websites. I have this question and this thing that I'm wondering about websites, and I want to get your opinion on it because you're a master of them. And we'll go through all of it. So that's just, again, another teaser. But before we do, I always like to ask all of my guests to start out to learn a little bit about them. What did the 13-year-old Johnny Sanquist want to be when he grew up?
Oh, man. The 13-year-old Johnny Sanquist definitely wanted to be a rock star. I mean, at that point in time, you know, I had like my first punk band appropriately named Destined to Fail. And that was what I thought I was going to do with my life, man. We had our, you know, our little Angel Fire site that we uploaded our songs to, but that was 13-year-old Johnny. Yeah,
I mean, it was
all music for me at that point in life.
That is incredible. I mean, do you still listen to some of the hits of Destined to Fail? I mean, get them up on Spotify.
Oh, no, those have been long destroyed. Yeah. Any MySpace page I used to have for a band extinct from the internet. So. Don't try to
is
find my, it.
Is MySpace still going, or do they, you know, they still have a website?
You know what? I think it's still alive. Like, I don't know how many years ago. I think Justin Timberlake bought it and like tried to turn it into just like a straight music site. I think it's still there.
Good for him. But good for him. Yeah, JT. I'm supportive of anything JT, so that's fine. I'll support his endeavors. Absolutely. But well, good. Well, so then tell me this then.
Yeah.
Going from Destined to Fail to founding your own copywriting and marketing company. Tell me about that journey, because I know you spent some time at Orion. You've kind of you've worked in the space for a while, but tell us how you went from the rock star to a founder and CEO.
Long and winding, accidental. Entrepreneur story, man. Yeah, so I got into the industry in 2009 with Orion. I started out on their client onboarding team, and that was my first introduction to advisors in like any capacity, right? Like I start my first day and they're like, we work with RIAs, and I'm like, that is amazing. Let me Google this real quick while you talk so I know what we're doing. I almost didn't even know what I was going to do when I got hired, but thank you, Randy and Eric, for trusting me, because I learned quick. But yeah, so I worked on onboarding. That's where I got my start with advisors. Ultimately, moved into the marketing team over at Orion, because more of my background is like in the literature and writing phase. So eventually moved over there, and I was the content coordinator there. My boss at the time on the marketing team, John Mackerel, you know, visionary marketing guy in the space, he decided to leave Orion and start his own agency. Mineral Interactive. And so I went with him and I was content director over there. And yeah, I mean, just after a couple of years of that agency life, I just decided to see if I could shake things out on my own, you know, get a little bit more control over who you're working with, you know, as a freelancer, and try that out. So I just started Three Grounds as a solo copywriter, not really with any expectations, more just kind of asked myself like, hey, in 10 years, am I going to probably wish I had tried something once? I felt like the answer was yes. So the story has grown from there.
I love that. And where did the Three Crowns name come from?
Oh, yeah. So officially, when I was thinking of a company name, I wanted to tie it to something bigger than myself. So I'm always, you know, trying to dig back into heritage and things like that. So my My dad's side of the family heritage is from Sweden. And so Three Crowns is the royal emblem of Sweden. So like, you know, next World Cup, if you watch the Swedish national team, they'll have like their Three Crowns patch. The hockey team has it. And that's where that name comes from.
That's incredible. That's free advertising for you. Because I mean, I know everybody's looking at the Three Crowns on the Swedes and they're like, where? Three Crowns.
Yeah. That SEO is going to work for me.
Yeah. I mean, that cost per click is going sky high for you on that one. All the, during the World Cup, you gotta pause advertising for a second.
Not quite the right user intent from search there. But actually, the funny thing is every once in a while, like, probably like once or twice a year for the past like 3 or 4 years, there's like an overseas like condensed milk brand called Three Crowns. And someone on Twitter will like tag us instead of like this company like complaining about their like condensed milk. And I'm just like, yeah, we're not who you're looking for.
Sorry, I can't really help you in that market. But if you need other marketing help, I'm happy to talk to you. Yeah, we can help there.
That's pretty funny. So.
That's amazing. Well, let's dive into this. I'm curious. Speaking of SEO and, you know, really AI from that standpoint, I know that AI is, some people are tired of talking about it. I'm just super interested on it because it feels like it's not going anywhere, but maybe it does. And I look back on these podcasts and be like, man, I was a loser. But AI, I mean, I'm curious from your extent, because it feels like there's like a big impact on the content and SEO side that AI is able to have. And you've seen the evolution of the space over the past 15, 20 years. What is the impact that AI will have in your mind or is having right now on content creation and marketing, more specifically for advisors? What do you feel is the impact, or is there not one in your mind?
So, I mean, we're definitely still early stages of really understanding what that impact is, right? I think that there's still a whole lot of questions, especially in a regulated environment, like for advisors of like, well, do you have to, if you use like ChatGPT to help you create content, do you have to disclose that somewhere, like do those types of things? So I think from my standpoint, right now, incredible like assistive tool. I think that AI in the content creation space from like a writing creative standpoint can reduce your creative time, your brainstorming by 50% or more, especially on short form content. I wouldn't say for long form content it's anything special, but short form and brainstorming, absolutely. And I think from a design standpoint, it's also really interesting. Right. So like you've got people using Midjourney, you know, Canva's got like a magic studio where you can put in text prompts and it'll create images for you. And that's also fascinating to me. I use that like in a LinkedIn post I wrote about AI a couple weeks ago. And so I was like, I'm going to have AI create an image for me to go with this. And it was like incredible. It's like super cool stuff. But I'm a big fan of AI, but I also feel like there's so many big open questions, you know, like on the creative side, especially having AI create images for you, like copyright and how it pulls from real artists' work to create its own images. There's a whole lot of like IP questions that we're nowhere near getting settled. But I'm an advocate for it, at least as an assistive tool. I think advisors are already so strapped for time with doing anything with marketing that if you can get yourself, you know, a quarter of the way there, 50% of the way there, and then add in your own voice and personalize it for yourself and for your clients, I love it.
Yeah, and you mentioned something there because I've always felt, and I mean, I think I've talked to enough advisors that marketing is so far down on advisors' list. They want to grow, but like the idea of, you know, content creation, like they don't know how often to write, where to place it. They don't have necessarily a strategy there. They run out of ideas, even though I think that they have a plethora of ideas. Like they just have a massive amount of ideas because they're talking to clients every single day and they have really intelligent thoughts there and they should find a way to communicate that to somewhere else. And I'm curious from your experience, are advisors adopting this? I mean, in my mind, this should open up the door to make advisors, all content creators, which then you get into the question of like, are you just going to have a reversion to the mean and everybody's going to be producing the same thing? But I guess is in your eyes, are advisors using it enough yet? And even though it's still in the early innings, and I know we talked about the creative side being really valuable, is it something that is worth advisors' time to spend in getting to know and starting to use so that they can create more consistent and depth in content?
Yeah. So, man, I've definitely witnessed some interesting use cases from conversations that I've had with advisors about how they're using it. I would say overall, probably not using it enough yet. I think I'm in the camp that like, hey, AI, generative AI, this is like the worst it's going to be, right? It's just going to keep getting better from here. And it's decently impressive with where it's at right now. And so I'm in the camp that like, hey, the people professionally who are going to succeed in the next 5 to 10 are going to be the people who can use this as a tool and understand it and understand, you know, prompt generation and everything like that. That's going to help them scale faster than the people who don't use it at all. Like I'm in that belief camp at this point. We actually got a client recently who asked ChatGPT, like, hey, who are marketing agencies who work with advisors? And we were one of the people that gave back to them. And so that's an interesting use case that is being used almost as like a search engine at times. And then another advisor I talked to who we're not working with told me that he's basically, like loading stuff in and having it kind of write blogs, and then he'll take it and tweak it and things from there, which I'm not a big fan of that approach, as you can probably tell from like how I'm talking about it and given that I run a custom content agency, but you know, so I think advisors have to get comfortable with it. I've seen like kind of a generational gap though. Like those stories are from like guys in their 30s. And then like the advisors I talk to who are, you know, 50, 60 plus, doesn't seem to be a lot of interest for them. And maybe for various reasons, like, you know, they're not in building mode as much as maybe these younger guys are, like they've built this company. But yeah, I think that you're going to continue to see it come more and more in a whole bunch of different use cases. And I think it's going to continue to revolutionize, like, especially research side of the industry, like fintech. I think it's going to be dramatically changed by AI, you know, portfolio building tools, be able to just say like, hey, I want a portfolio to use text, right? Text input, say I want a portfolio that's built like this and then have it done for you. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that to me is especially where the application in the near term that's going to be really, really powerful for advisors is at. And that's not even on the marketing side, right? Mm-hmm. But I'm a big fintech aficionado, so I always like slide my way into that conversation.
Yeah. You know, I can see, you know, there's two things there. One is this is a generational shift, right? Because I think that it's not going to happen overnight. I think it's just going to be so gradual, because as that older generation of advisors that's not into it gets out, then the newer generation are just going to grow up with this as part of their journey forever. It's just the same reason why tech is easier for the younger generation than the older generation. They grew up in it. And I think you see that. So it's not like it's going to be an overnight thing, but to your point, I think it just constantly gets better. Yeah. And you know what's interesting though, that I do fear with AI is it kind of goes to what was happening, and it still kind of happens, not as much in the wealth tech space, of saying, you know, we're integrated. And integration was all just like, just an SSO. It was like, what are we doing? That's not integrate. Like, you can't do anything. And everybody's going to be like, we use AI. And it's like, well, what are you doing with AI? And they're not using it to the depth of it. And it's just like a buzzword to sell people. Mm-hmm. And then people get frustrated because it doesn't really work the way that they intended. And then they lose faith in it. Like, that is a worry, because I agree with you. Fintechs and wealth techs have a ton of opportunity to leverage this technology to create an immense value and differentiation to the advisor community.
Oh, absolutely. I was a little salty. Like when first ChatGPT first came out, I kind of made fun of some fintech firms who were like the very first ones to roll out like the integration. I was like, what are you integrating at this point? Like, you know, we've been like, you're just trying to say you have this buzzword here. So I mean, you're going to see some of that for sure. I think it's just going to become another way for the really innovative fintech teams to differentiate themselves from the ones who aren't. Right?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that the more people that invest time and resources into it and better understand it, it's going to separate themselves. Just like the people that did with the internet and everything of that nature that got really skilled, they can create unique value. And you have this kind of separation of knowledge that will continue to merge, but there is definitely an opportunity there. And before we switch gears from AI, I do want to just ask, I'm always curious, What tools out there are super interesting that y'all are finding you're using? You mentioned Canva and ChatGPT. Are there any other AI tools that you found to be in Midjourney you mentioned super interesting or of value?
Yeah. So I think, you know, ChatGPT, everybody knows. Canva a lot of people know about it. I don't know how many people know it's got like a text image piece of it. Midjourney's the other one that a lot of people seem to know about. Actually, for anybody who's listening that uses HubSpot, HubSpot has got some new AI tools that will, which are pretty interesting. I've tested them out like for ad creative. Like you load in like, hey, I want to run ads on this channel. Here's three topics that it's going to be about, and then it'll generate some ad copy for you. Not super good, but it's the type of thing where it's like, well, maybe that might get you like past the blank stage, right? There is one, I think it's called copy.ai, mm-hmm. maybe, which is a content copywriting AI, which I've dabbled in too. And then there is one, I'm blanking on the name, but I want to say it's maybe, hopefully I don't send people to some like virus-filled website. I think it might be beautiful.ai, but it's like a deck creation AI, specifically to build like PowerPoint decks for you and have them designed. So you kind of put in your text and what you want for each slide, and then it creates it for you. And I've used that a bit in the past, and it's got some interesting application. So
I love that.
Those would be like my five or six, I guess, that I dabble in.
I love that. Well, hopefully people, I just think that it's just good for people just to dabble and try them out, whether they're perfect or not, just to get an understanding of it. That's why I always like to talk about the tools out there. But I want to switch gears a little bit to just general marketing. We can gear away from the AI side, but I know that you help firms with just overall marketing, and some mm-hmm. of the things that you've talked about are both influencer marketing and how to better leverage testimonials. Testimonials being a little bit of a newer section of marketing because the SEC finally gave approval on some of those. But I want to dive into both of those separately because I think if we combine it, I think we lose something. So I want to talk about influencer marketing. I don't know if many advisors really think about influencer marketing because I guess you have centers of influences, COIs, but what is, from your perspective, influencer marketing?
So influencer marketing would be someone who's not a client. Well, I guess they could be a client, but I'm going to just draw a line and say they're not a client, but they are influential among the people that you want to work with. I think that it's more useful for advisors to think about an influencer in a narrower scope than like what we would think of in like the broad consumer market. Because like the average advisor firm, they're a small business. Like they're not going to partner with Kim Kardashian. But if they've got a niche and they're like, yeah, we work with physical therapists and that's who we serve really well. Or like our market is people who own like a CrossFit gym. Like I've talked to advisors who this is like their type of niche. And then it's looking at saying like, okay, like, what podcasts do these people listen to? What YouTube shows do they watch? Like who has influence in these smaller communities? And that's who the influencer is. It's a little bit broader than like your COI. Like you said, like it's not just your local CPA, but it's also narrower than, so a true celebrity.
So I'm going to make this conversation like you're talking to a five-year-old or a fifth grader, maybe a five-year-old or a fifth grader, either way. So for those that aren't aware of influencer marketing, right? Because how does this work, right? Like, how do you find these people? I'm assuming that they're like, is there like a broker dealer, like a broker marketplace to broker you a deal with influencers for your segment? Like, I know that we used to do podcast advertising. There's something on that side, but how does this all work in the real world?
Yeah. I mean, there's certainly like creative and talented agencies that you could reach out to in certain cases. I think most of the time that wouldn't be super applicable. I think most of the time, like a personal outreach would be the way that an advisor would go. And you know, understandably, it's like a pay to play type of model, right? Like, hey, I'm going to pay you to do an ad for me type of thing with all the disclosures and stuff that go along with that, right? But
14 pages worth.
Yeah, that's what it'd be. Like, okay, maybe let's just say there's this niche like YouTube personality that's applicable to your audience, right? It's a matter of finding their team, reaching out to them, explaining the situation to them, be like, hey, we both serve the same market. I think I could, a lot of times with these asks, it's not dissimilar to trying to get on somebody's podcast. Like, hey, we've got the same audience. We can give each other a boost. Would love to, have you kind of be part of my community and partner up with me in this way. And that's the starting point.
And finally, I guess, like what it feels like this is great for someone with like a niche, right? Like if you have a really specific niche, I think that that's like you, it, being a generalist, this strategy may not make the most sense, but like it seems like it's an untapped market, at least for the investment community, because I know that all these other brands do it. You look at all the Super Bowls and you know, all that type of stuff. And, you know, Kim Kardashian's always slinging product on her Instagram.
Who knows? Maybe you could get her.
Yeah. I mean, she slung too much crypto and got fined from it. But anyhow, we're not going down that path, right? You got to be careful what you're slinging. But, you know, but like, what is the, like, is this like a untapped opportunity, or is it just like it's not like in terms of an ROI of creating some prospect and lead flow?
I mean, it's for sure untapped because I just people are afraid to tap into it. First of all, you know, it's still brand new, and in the tech world, there's a huge advantage to being first mover. I think there's much less of a appetite for that, right, on the advisory side. And really, the only real concrete example that I can think of is I see, and this, I don't know if this falls under client testimonial or influencer based on the relationship, but like Dynasty Financial puts a lot of like athletes out through their social media that have a relationship with the firm. And so that's been interesting. I've kind of been studying that a bit and seeing how they've been positioning things. And I think you're right. Like, first of all, I'm a proponent of find a niche and go after them, even if it is a little bit broader at first, because good marketing is specific marketing. And so the generalist, it may not be as useful for them, but I think I would be really interested in this and going after it. I don't think it's all too unlike just, like I said, tapping into podcast swaps, like find someone influential and figure out something that benefits both of you.
Yeah. I mean, I to be honest, I've known about influencer marketing. I never even thought about it in this realm. I thought that when I was doing some research for the pod, I just was like, wow, that is like such an interesting avenue and an innovative way of looking at what other companies are doing outside of our industry. And how do we then bring that into our industry? And I think that open-mindedness we need more of in our industry, because we've stuck to our ways of referrals, COIs, and hope and pray. And the hope and pray method is a little bit, it's dicey at times. Like it doesn't work all the time. So you need to have some more clarity in terms of your marketing.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, man. I just think everything about wealth management is, as an industry, I wouldn't say in turmoil, but having a big shift, right? Like over these last 5 to 10 years, as we've shifted from like this wealth manager idea to this almost life coach phase that we're like trending towards with all the, you know, behavioral finance and everything.
Yeah.
And in my mind, at least, I mean, that strategy works better coupled with that type of professional than the former, like, you know, more banker personality professional, right? Because at its heart, influencer marketing is a trust, a credibility building tactic, because essentially you're taking somebody that your audience already trusts and I'm really kind of like trying to transfer some of that credibility over to you. You know, that's, we keep using like Kim K as our example, but that's why she works, because she's got all these people who already have this affinity for her. So when she puts a new product in front of them, like that trust transfers, right?
Yeah.
And so that's what ultimately, if you would go after an influencer strategy, that's the goal. It's like to get someone who's already trusted to transfer some of that trust into you. And so that works really well with advisor as, you know, comprehensive planner as life coach model.
Yeah. It's easier to sell that from an influencer to the next step of saying, this person's more holistic, life coach, et cetera, going against the grain, as opposed to, hey, this is your next stockbroker. It's going to be really, you're going to be really great at finding you the next great Visa or the next Facebook, right? Like that just doesn't sound exciting as much. And you know, you bring something up, and I think the listener base may be tired of me asking every guest this because I'm just so curious about it. You bring something up about how the advisor community has evolved, but I think that it has changed a little bit. And I think from like in different circles, in tight circles, it has. But like I was just at the coffee this morning with an advisor and like they're like, well, how do you make it work being a W-2 instead of a 1099 employee as an advisor? And I'm like, what world are we in? That's just like, that's how it's like, we're getting to yeah. that point, right? Like it's becoming more and more like that, but they're still ingrained in that and they don't see what's really happening across like some tighter knit communities are. And I'm just curious, like what's going to be the impetus of change for this industry? It doesn't feel, it feels like we are changing a little bit, but like there doesn't really need to be a change because managing money, you can do it and you know, you get 80, 50 million, 100 million, you wait 10 years, it's going to double if you just do your thing the right way. And you don't have to grow. You don't have to add new relationships. You just have to stay. So what's going to be the impetus to that change in your mind? I'm so curious of what's going to cause advisors to have this like a holistic overhaul to the industry.
Man. So I think there's two pieces to this. One, I think important to understand is, you know, when I'm looking at the industry and talking about trends and things like that, I'm always looking at it through a lens of the RIA landscape, right? And like the BD landscape, so different. It's almost like two different worlds. There's not a whole lot of impetus for changing those very large structures, as opposed to in the RIA space, much more nimble, smaller companies that can make change much more rapidly, right? The second piece to that is I do think that consumer expectations are going to be changing. I think that takes a long time for those generational perceptions to influence the market because you really have to wait, you know, I mean, it's like a 20-year process, right? For that to really like take hold. But if you look at, you know, all the surveys and things being done with like Gen Z and millennials, you know, I'm a millennial on the older side, but like younger millennials, as they start to like age up into the demographic for most advisors, because like, you know, most advisors aren't working with those groups yet. Some are, most aren't. But as they become like the dominant age, if you look at what those younger people are interested in, what they say they're interested in, they are saying that they're not really interested in having somebody who's a money manager. They're interested in somebody who wants to be personal with them and set their life goals and act in that way. And so I think it's going to be a natural and required shift, but I think it's going to continue to take a lot of time for that to really like take full effect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it goes to kind of what we were talking about earlier with AI, right? The generation, it's going to take generations to be ingrained deeply. And I think you're right. As consumer preferences, that's a long game. It's just like when everybody was talking about the generational shift in wealth and the actions you needed to take today to capture the generational shift in wealth. I always was like, that's a 40-year process. Like it's not like one day all the boomers are dead and the money's going to millennials and Zers. It's like over the next 40 years that's going to happen, and some people are still going to be around in the industry and some people aren't. Like you're not going to, so it's a tough thing. Like you've got to be nimble and flexible as the industry grows.
Every year I'm writing articles about the Great Wealth Transfer.
I'm like,
is it happening yet?
It's unbelievable. I mean, we all talk about it. We're like, start preparing. Like, it reminds me of Y2K. It's like, get your canned goods, back up everything. The clocks are not going to be able to go to 2000. It's going to, watch out. Like, they don't have an ability to do 200, right?
Yeah, what a time.
Yeah, what a time. Yeah. And I mean, God forbid something happens, but I just don't see the wealth transfer, generational shift in wealth happening right away, but it will over time. But
yeah, it's drawn out process. Yeah,
it is. Testimonials. Mm-hmm. Give an update on to some of those individuals that may have listened and be like, I can't do testimonials. I'm in the RIA industry. Give an update of what the landscape of testimonials allow for these days.
So testimonials, I'm starting to see a much higher adoption than influencer marketing that we were talking about, right? Like influencer marketing, not much traction going on. Testimonials, firms are really starting to like get their arms around what that means. So at the simplest, most basic, client testimonial is that you can now actually feature your own clients in their own words, talking about the fact that they do, in fact, work with you and that all your clients are not these faceless ghosts anymore. And so again, from a trust building, from a social proof standpoint, this is a fantastic evolution for advisors. There's a whole bunch of very finely dotted rules that go along with that. I think the most important ones that I'm that I really focus on is you can't cherry pick. So basically what people have taken the approach of is that if you're going to gather testimonials from clients who are going to say good things about you, you have to ask every single person you work with to give you feedback. And so the way that people have been managing that is through, you know, an NPS survey or something like that, where they just send something out to every client and they say, let us know how we're doing. And then collect those all together in a place, or send out and say, like, you know, a link to their Google My Business and say, could you leave a review? And then everything's in this one central repository where everybody can see all the responses. And you can just direct people over to there. And we keep coming back to WealthTech. WealthTender is a startup that's based around this, about compliant testimonial gathering. I like what they're about. And so that's a one way that people can, you know, try to manage this through like a through a partnership solution. But I think the testimonials are probably the most powerful marketing tool that any company has at their disposal.
And I agree, right? Because, I mean, if you think about how firms have always grown, it's always been referrals. And why do referrals work? It's because it's a testimonial from one person that I can trust to another person. I get behind the scenes and I'm not getting, I remove that veil of sales, right? Of someone selling me on something on right. that. But so if I go and do an NPS survey and I do it to everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I like in there, I leave an ability for comments. Am I able to then take those comments or some of those comments randomly drawn and put them on my website? Or do I have to give a full exposure to the entire database in order to use testimonials?
Yes.
Or do you know so, that? Because I know it's in SEC regulations are tough to understand.
I'm getting the compliance consultation here. So my understanding, and this could be 80% right, could be 90% right. My understanding is that you have to be able to point people to a full repository of where reviews have been left for you. And so I think actually this is a good time. This is a good time for us to differentiate between reviews and, I guess, case study is what I would say.
Okay.
Okay. So I'd say, like, if you're gathering reviews, my understanding is you've got to expose that entire list, right? So, like in the Google reviews example, very easy to just take two of those 5 stars, put them on your website, and then drop a link that, you know, for all reviews, click here. And then that, and then you've disclosed that it's not all these 5 stars. We just grabbed these ones, but the rest are here. And so if you're going to feature, you know, like client quotes, things like that, I do think that that's also a type of thing where you have to pull from that central repository. Case study, on the other hand, is where you're having like a conversation with someone and building a story around them. And I don't think that because you're just talking to them and, you know, publishing a video or whatever to your site, that's not the same thing. Like, you don't have to have a case study or a conversation with every single client, right? Because that's a different piece entirely. That's how I'm understanding the divide.
I think that both of those are super valuable. And I think case studies is something that I know that we did in the technology world when we were running our technology business for some time. And those are super powerful because the ability to point someone and then someone can say, yeah, that's me. That's what I need. And so it doesn't hit everybody. But if you can have these, like, if you're focused on a more generalist type of firm and you have, you know, maybe 3 or 4 personas of individuals you target, create some case studies for each of them and then push those out. And some of your market's going to be like, that's me. I want that. And they're going to call you. And I think that there can be super valuable, especially if done and created the right way, you know, with video and written copy and et cetera, whatever it may be. I think it's a super interesting way of marketing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
All right. We're going to wrap up here in a second, but I teased with this and I just want to get your perspective because I don't talk to many people that are kind of, I consider like geniuses of websites and you focus on building a lot of websites, especially advisors' websites. And it was something as I was doing the research that I was just super interesting. Our digital storefront, which is the website, seems to like, it just is now like it you have to have it. It just is like it's a commodity, necessity of any business. You've got to have a website. But I don't feel, and I know that maybe the design a little bit has changed, but like the way that we show ourselves digitally hasn't really changed. I guess you could say social media, but websites are websites, and they don't seem like they add any more value today than they did 15 years ago. They tell me about the firm. I read about it. I see who works there and I get an address and I can put a comment on a box that goes to an inbox that I don't even know where it goes. I don't know where it goes.
Oh man, the form field. Yeah.
Right? The form field. But nothing has changed in decades in something that is so necessary to be a business these days. And there's like, it feels like that's ripe for innovation. And so I'm just curious, like, is there anything that's coming that you see in a trend or the future of websites that are like, are they just always just going to be kind of like a front of a store and it's just always going to have a neon lit sign and that's just the nature of it?
Oh man, I love that question. That's a different way than most people phrase it. You know, most people don't really recognize that the historical look back at like websites are just kind of the same like they've been. So I think the answer to that is your website has got to be, it has to have two elements to it. Element number one is I think the old way of building website is that it's like a brochure. It's about you. It's about your company. It's about what you do. So element one is flip the focus so that it's completely outward facing. So it's speaking to the client and speaking to their problems and that you've got a secondary role in that. It's like you said earlier with case studies, oh, I see myself. Like that's the effect. And so that probably seems very basic. There's still a huge variety. I'd probably say the majority of advisor websites that take the first approach where it's just like, here we are. We are really good at this stuff. Come work with us. And that's the opposite of the story that you want to tell. You want your website to tell the story of you have this problem. We can help you on the path. Here's the fix to it. If you want help on it, let us know. We can help. So a more story-based structure to the messaging of the site. That's element one. Element two is figuring out how you can implement true interaction into your website. And I guess I say true interaction. Some of this, maybe some people wouldn't classify as true, but interactive elements. That can be as simple as swapping out that form field on your contact to going direct to, you know, like schedule a meeting right now via my Calendly or my HubSpot link or whatever it is. Just that is a slight subtle change that puts the user, the client, in control, right? It's just a very small UX difference between I'm sending this message into I don't know where versus I'm remaining in control of my journey. And chatbots, man, I'm going to actually bring things back to AI, right? So like I like chatbots as a minimal piece of a site. I don't like when they pop up and they're like in your face and like talk to us, ask us questions. But if they're there as an option, and firms are afraid of that because of the compliance of like, okay, how do we archive these conversations? How do we man this? Who's in charge of running the chatbot during the day? You know, you can build custom chatbot, you know, off ChatGPT, run your website through it, create just a kind of a dynamic FAQ, right? So somebody can come to your site, ask basic questions, he'll give back responses that you've recorded, etc. I'll stop there. I could keep going, but I think that client-centered interactive is the way that you bridge from, you know, from web 1.0 into full web 2.0.
I think that that's the interactivity side of it is super interesting. You know, there's a company, I think it's called VidAsk or VideoAsk. It's based on Typeform. Oh, yeah. Typeform created, and it's a super it's a super interesting concept that I don't think has taken off enough, but it's like an interactive where they can kind of ask questions and you can create branches and there's like this human to human interaction there. But I think that interactiveness is there, right? And, you know, you think about what happens with, you know, virtual reality. Does it become decentralized? Do you need to wear goggles? Are they able to kind of have a test yeah. meeting of like conversation about their situation via your website? Like there is super interesting stuff that I don't feel is that out of the realm, but I think it all gets back to something you said early on was, you know, like it's got to be a brochure and it's got to be, you know, what case studies is like, it's got to say like, that's me. I can see myself there. And that goes to something that you and Matt Holleran, our friend with the Top Advisor Marketing Podcast talked about was creating authentic content. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's super valuable when designing a website that if you just go at it and say, I'm just going to create this templated frame website, it's just not going to work for you. But if you can make it authentic, you can be better. And I'm curious from your perspective, like, This may sound like a stupid question, but like, what's the key to making authentic content? Like, how do you tell someone just to be themselves and make content? Like, that seems so hard for people, though.
Oh my gosh, man! I feel like I'm so over authenticity in marketing. It's like it was the word of the year in 2023 for like Merriam-Webster and all this stuff. And yeah, I feel no. That's how I feel about marketing experts.
How do you be more yourself? Then just be you,
man. Yeah. Like, it's like these hippie vibes. Like, be yourself.
So, what are you talking about? I am authentic. This is who I am. Are you saying that I'm not authentic? How do you know who I am? I am authentic.
Yeah, it's a little bit like your first reaction could be like, who are you to tell me to be more authentic? I take a little bit different tack on it. So what I'd say is that your authenticity needs to be routed through empathy. And so you don't need to... Yes, if you get on camera, like, unless you're just like some complete performative person, like, you're probably going to be pretty close to like how you act and how you talk in real life, unless you're just like super uncomfortable or you are really good at putting on a fake facade persona, right? And so I don't think like telling people to be more authentic is always super insightful. I think telling them to be more empathetic in their marketing is, though. And again, that brings us back to, well, what's empathy? It's being able to put yourself in the situation, the scenario, and really demonstrate that you understand what the people you're talking to are going through at a deep level. And I think if you do that, if you actually are empathetic towards your clients, towards your prospects, then that comes through as authenticity anyway. And so that's the route. I don't know. Authenticity without empathy is just narcissism, right? Like, it's just, it doesn't do anybody any good without this side of the equation.
I think that that's also why this idea of psychology and behavioral finance and behavioral psychology is so important, because you've got to understand the challenges that people are going through psychologically. And you can't just be like, it's fine. Like, everything's going to be fine. Like, we're going to talk about your finances. Understanding where they're at and how challenging it is psychologically for them to open themselves up and expose themselves of the fear of being judged and all that type of stuff, and helping to communicate why they should feel comfortable in your sphere. And if you can do that effectively without just saying, trust me, I'm telling you, you will be comfortable here.
Yeah.
Then you've got something, and that becomes valuable, very valuable at that point.
Yeah.
All right. We're going up on time. I mean, I knew that this was going to happen. I'm looking at the clock, and we could probably talk for another couple hours. But I want to wrap up with my two final questions. Maybe we'll do kind of a lightning round here.
Let's do it.
The first question I always like to ask, I love learning. I continue to learn every day. I love learning through reading, and I like to read books that other people tell me to read that are much smarter than me, like yourself. So I'm always curious, what's one of those books out there that you think everybody should read if they haven't, or reread if they've already read it before?
I'm gonna give you, hopefully, a book you've never gotten before. I have it on my desk.
Okay.
Oh, there we go. Our National Parks by John Muir.
All right. I've never gotten that one.
So, all right. Good. You know, John Muir, really famous naturist from back in the day, and collection of essays, mostly of like wildlife and nature in Yosemite Valley. It's a transcendental read to me.
I love
that. It's just a recording of, you know, his kind of journeys and the life within this area.
All right. That sounds like a fun one to pick up and read when you can like sit and just be transcendental with him and just like,
it's like a decompression read for me. Absolutely. Yeah.
I love that. I love that. All right. Last question is, you know, we talked about a lot and there's a lot that we didn't even get to. So you can go the whole range. If there's one piece of actionable advice you hope our listeners take away from the podcast today, what's that one piece of actionable advice that they can maybe implement today, tomorrow, to better themselves, better their future business, their current business, whatever it may be?
So like you said, I mean, I'm the website guy. So number one takeaway, take a look at your website and audit how many times you say I, me, we versus you. The yous should drastically outweigh the I, me, mys. That tells you that you are speaking to your audience, that you have a focus on them and what they need and not on yourself. And if you're overloaded on those first person pronouns, time to redo the site.
Love that. That's so actionable. I can already see people right now going to the website and starting to count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Yeah. It's like that classic 80-20 rule.
Exactly. Johnny Sandquist, man, it's been a true honor. It's been a pleasure. It's been a lot of fun. I know I'm a big fan of yours and continue to follow your journey. And I know that many of the listeners will as well. So what's the best way for them to continue to follow you and also to get in touch with you and potentially work with you?
Yeah. So our team is reachable at 3crownsmarketing.com. That is the 3 spelled out, not the digit. And just search up my name, Johnny Sandquist, on LinkedIn. That's where I spend most of my time. Connect with me there.
Love it. Johnny Sandquist, thanks so much for spending time with us here on Bridging the Gap. I appreciate you. Stay well, be well, and looking forward to talking with you soon.
Thanks, Matt. Appreciate you, Matt.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Bridging the Gap. Don't forget to give us a rating and let us know what you think.